Hi, welcome to Derm Discussions. In 2017, the average temperature across the United States was 54.6 degrees Fahrenheit, 2.6 degrees above the average. This made it the third warmest year in 123 years since the US started keeping records of such temperatures. Even more, the five warmest years on record for the US have all occurred since 2006. We may have reason to believe that this trend is likely to occur over the next years. According to the United States National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the average American likely will see 27 to 50 days over 90 degrees each year. So why is this relevant for dermatology? For one, the impacts of climate change are far-reaching, physically and metaphorically. Additionally, changes in our planet's climate and increasing temperatures, propelled by human activities, are global health concerns. Generally speaking, the impacts that we are seeing today, and the ones of tomorrow, will likely have significant consequences on public health. And it is wise for all stakeholders in healthcare, from pulmonologists to dermatologists to policymakers and the patients themselves, to better understand the role they can play in advocacy, awareness, and mitigation strategies. Also, climate change can certainly have direct and indirect dermatologic consequences, a reality that the dermatologist should not overlook. For this episode of Derm Discussions, Dr. Brad Glick spoke with Dr. Misha Rosenbach of the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania about the dermatologic and public health impacts of climate change. Conversation touched on the urgency and importance of this conversation, the relevance of dermatology to these broader global issues, the roles dermatologists can play as resources for patients, as well as various mitigation strategies. Dr. Rosenbach talked about the adjustments in large-scale and individual behaviors and choices that can have an impact on humanity's overall carbon footprint. As he stressed, this is an issue that spreads into virtually every aspect of healthcare. As such, it becomes necessary to generate relevant discussions and learning opportunities so that healthcare professionals across specialties can more fully understand what's at stake for the health of our planet and its people.
Welcome to another Derm Discussions, May 2021. I'm Dr. Brad Glick, a board-certified dermatologist, and this episode is going to discuss climate change and its impact on dermatology. We are absolutely thrilled to have Dr. Misha Rosenbach with us. Dr. Rosenbach is an associate professor of dermatology and internal medicine at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, and is also co-founder and co-chair of the AAD's Expert Resource Group for Environmental Affairs. Misha, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thanks for having me and highlighting this important topic, Brad. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, before I begin, I actually want to highlight a couple of things myself. I really feel like our listeners should look up an article actually written by you and Ben Kaffenberger, published in October of 2016, on the effect of climate change on skin disease in North America. I've read this myself. I think it's a very important article. And then actually just published in August of 2020, a summary also by yourself and Genevieve Silva, looking at a whole bunch of areas in climate change and its impact on dermatology, published in the International Journal of Women's Dermatology. And so for our listeners, please pick that up. I think it's very important. And I'll tell you, I learned so much in reading that. And with that said, I want to jump right in. And Misha, tell us about climate change in general. What is our current understanding in medicine in general? And I think after that, just jump into how it's impacting us in dermatology.
Okay, great. So, boy, that's a lot to start with. And I know that podcasts should be a discussion and a dialogue. And I have a tendency to sort of monologue and talk really fast. And so for listeners' sakes, I'll leave some pauses and let you chime in if you want to elaborate or want me to elaborate on anything. But so I think let's start with some people have sort of a reflex reaction to hearing a topic on climate change and feel like, well, you know, what does it have to do with medicine, or what does it have to do with dermatology, or, you know, this is politically polarizing. And I will say first, we follow the science as physicians and clinicians, and the state of the scientific understanding of climate change is really, it's reached five sigma certainty. So that's the highest level of scientific certainty. The consensus worldwide and here in the US, regardless of political party and all science, is that we are witnessing effects now as a result of human emissions, particularly burnings of fossil fuels, that lead to increase in heat trapping gases in the atmosphere, particularly CO2 and methane. And burning fossil fuels leading to those heat trapping gases means that the rays of the sun are coming to the earth, and normally more heat would reflect out into space, but because of those heat trapping gases, they act as a blanket, trap more heat in the atmosphere, more of that gets absorbed by the water, that leads to ice sheets melting and more extreme weather events, as there's just more energy in the ocean to charge storms. And the hotter temperatures lead to changing patterns of temperature and climate in different areas. And so I think the challenge in conveying this is, you know, people will say things like, well, the world has always changed, or the weather always changes. And, you know, the Earth's been here for over 4 billion years. If you look at maps of the rate of rise of CO2, first of all, it's been relatively tightly within an upper bound of not even where it is now. It's about 420 parts per million when we're recording this. But if you look at all of human history, it's never been close to this. And if you look back over 800,000 to millions of years based on, you know, looking at ice core analyses, first of all, CO2 has never been this high. Second of all, it's never gone this high this fast. And so the natural world is not equipped to respond to a rate of change that, since the Industrial Revolution, humans have been forcing the world to go through. And that leads to a lot of changes in medicine. And everyone's here for medicine. I don't want to like focus on like climate science and these things. I want to focus on the impacts on patients and population-based health, which will be the second half of my monologue-y answer. But let me pause there and see if you have any questions.
Well, I think, elaborate on that. You know, you say that, but I don't think we have to apologize for this at all. It's super important. You know, the other thing that I gleaned from doing some reading on this, and I've not been very well educated on this, just the temperature and what's happening to the temperature every year. Everyone seems to say, well, it's okay, that's normal. The temperature's been going up a little bit kind of every year. I don't think that's good. And it's going to continue to go up based on what I read as we predict ahead the next 20 to 40 years. So I think that impacts us in medicine as well, too, particularly in dermatology, like, you know, more heat intensity. People are also outside more, and therefore, ergo, there's going to be more skin cancer. That's just, you know, an observation for someone who's clearly not expert on this subject. But let me keep going and let you continue the monologue.
Sure. I will talk about the dermatologic disease in a second, but you know, just what you just touched on, it's not just for the next 20 to 40 years, because the reason that scientists are emphasizing the need to act quickly now is, as we move past certain tipping points, one of the challenges is we don't really have carbon removal technology at scale to lower things that are out in the atmosphere yet. And it's not just that what we're doing now will lead to changes in the next 20 to 40 years. It's what we're doing now will lead to changes for thousands to tens of thousands of years. So, and importantly, I think people hear numbers like, well, 2050, you know, we should have a carbon neutral economy by 2050, or we should, you know, or, you know, we want to avoid 1.5 degrees Celsius rate of rise of temperature over pre-industrial baseline by 2100, you know, Paris Accord goals. First of all, in the US, and I assume most of your listeners are here in North America, but you know, we're more maybe used to Fahrenheit. And so then it's like, well, what does 1.5 even mean? And so the truth is, though, that the choices that we make over the next decade have a disproportionately large impact on generations and generations to come. And it's very much like what we see with COVID, where if you wait until things are horrifically bad, it takes a really long time for them to peak when you take action, and the case count keeps going up for time even after you decide to take action, because that's locked in change. And if you act early, you can avoid exponential worsening. And it's very similar with climate change. And the one analogy that I think really brings it home is, you know, we know there's more CO2 in the air than has ever been there, but we're still emitting record numbers year over year. So there's a question of whether maybe last year we peaked. That might be optimistic, but whatever, the thing is, you're supposed to think about like a bathtub that's full of water, and the faucet is turned on to max. So that faucet that's turned on to max is our continuous CO2 emissions, but the bathtub is already overflowing with water. It's already too much water there. So we have to shut down our CO2 emissions. We have to turn off that faucet, but even so, there's still too much CO2. It's still an overflowing bathtub of CO2. And so we have a number of problems. We have to take action now, but you've touched on some of the health issues, and I do want most of this podcast to be focused on that. So are you okay if we pivot to—
Yeah, let's jump into dermatology, but I am going to ask you, as we come back to this and bring it together and get some closure, is to talk about maybe a little bit about mitigation strategies, but go ahead. Let's talk about how this is impacting dermatology.
Okay, so it's impacting the whole world. So dermatologists live in the world. So let's start with that. All joking aside, the US military refers to climate change as a threat multiplier, where it makes existing problems much worse and creates new problems. And so, you know, if you think about ISIS in the Middle East, that's bad. You don't, you know, that's not a dermatological issue. But there are a number of scientific papers that show that as the heat goes up, it leads to drought. As there's drought, rural populations move into cities, and then there's unrest due to kind of not enough money or food or jobs to go around. And then that unrest foments. And that there are legitimate scientific papers that have suggested that that was a big contributing factor to the civil unrest in Syria and certainly in parts of sub-Saharan Africa around Lake Chad. And there are a number of places you can point to and say, well, does this directly affect dermatologists if it's things around the globe? But, you know, we see, again, during COVID, that we're all citizens of the same planet, and this is the only planet. And so things that happen around the globe impact all of us. But if you just think about, let's go with New York, as we're, well, I mean, I'm in Philadelphia, so we consider ourselves like the sixth suburb of New York. So New York is like basically at this point a subtropical city. And so we think of equatorial regions as the tropics, and then as you move out from there, you get to subtropics and then temperate areas. But based on weather and precipitation and temperature, you could reasonably classify a lot of the US now as subtropical region. One of the things we see is vector-borne illnesses that traditionally are in equatorial regions, you know, central, northern South America, have now moved out. And so we see the Aedes mosquito that carries dengue, chikungunya, and Zika. You can get, you know, cases of those things in the continental US, and the sandfly that carries leishmaniasis, you have endemic leishmaniasis in Texas now at this point. You see ticks that are typically, you know, centered here in Pennsylvania and in kind of the mid-Atlantic, expanding out into areas of Maine and Canada, where dermatologists have gone their whole careers without expecting to see erythema chronica migrans. And so when a patient walks in the door in, you know, parts of Canada and has a big red rash, they're not going to think, oh, that's a tick bite, let me give you doxycycline. They've gone their whole career without ticks being in that area, but with more mild weather and more mild winters, expanding habitat of the deer and the Ixodes tick, you're now seeing both earlier bites of ticks in months that they did not typically exist, and later in the calendar year. So you see cases of Lyme in, you know, March and April, as opposed to, you know, May and June, and you see them farther north. And that's really just scratching the tip of the iceberg. You know, you mentioned this article in International Journal of Women's Dermatology, so I do want to give a shout out to the Women's Derm Society, who dedicated an entire issue of their journal to climate change in dermatology. And so there are articles in that talking about atopic dermatitis, pemphigus, psoriasis, aging, skin cancer that you mentioned, different contactants. So poison ivy is more virulent in higher CO2, to these insect-borne things, to extreme weather events, to food and nutrition, to issues with migrations and forced migration and refugees. And I mean, the list really goes on and on and on to the point that, I mean, we have a session at the Academy that, you know, for the AADVMX, I think we had like 3 hours of recorded content, and we turned away speakers and speaker suggestions because there's just too much to cover. And so it really touches on many, many different areas of our field.
So how do we handle it? I mean, we'll talk about a little bit mitigation strategies. I've got a couple of more detailed questions to ask you as well, but kind of where is it all now? Where is it looking like it's going? And kind of I'd ask, like, how do we slow it down? What does the future look like? How do we wrap ourselves around this and get it under a little bit better control?
Well, okay. So I'm very science minded. And so, you know, I think we're trained to practice evidence-based medicine, and we look for where's the like level one evidence. You know, we want to choose a therapy for our patients that has double blind, placebo controlled, gold standard clinical trial level evidence. And so I think in general, what you often hear people say is, well, I'm not a climate scientist, but, and then they say something that's sort of nonsense. And so like, I'm a dermatologist, I'm not a climate scientist, but we have climate scientists, right? And so if you could go back 6 months into the COVID pandemic, would you wish that everyone did what New Zealand did and like strictly followed the science, reached COVID zero, did everything that experts said, and was, you know, living normal life? Because then, you know, you keep case counts down, you mask, you isolate, test, trace, isolate, flatten the curve, you do well-designed studies to figure out which therapeutics work for your disease, and then you wait with those mitigation strategies until there's an effective vaccine, and then you roll it out. And so if you could look around the globe and you could look at these places, it's like, well, you know, what was the difference in the response? There was a fantastic interview literally yesterday with the health minister of Singapore, and it was by the BBC. The BBC was interviewing the health minister of Singapore, and they said, you know, how did you do so well with the pandemic? And the health minister said, how come, no, the better question is, how come the UK did so poorly? And they said, what do you mean? And they're like, well, we followed the UK's disaster, you know, pandemic preparedness rules. We did what the scientists said, and we were able to mitigate the worst effects of the pandemic. Some countries did not do that. And so with climate change, I think we should listen to the scientists, right? And so it is very clear that the more fossil fuels we burn, the more CO2 and methane, that short-acting fossil fuel gas, we emit into the air, the more heat trapping there is and the more rapid changes there are. And once glaciers melt, they're not going to just immediately reform. And once we chop down forests, they're not going to immediately regrow. And when we plant trees, we plant like a single type of tree. It's not really like an old growth forest that's sequestering a lot of carbon. And so I think the main thing to know is that it's actually not hard to make a change right now that will be better. So the cheapest energy is installing new solar. It is cheaper to install new solar panels and get energy from that than it is to use existing coal power plants. And so we have the technology right now where if we just exert like our will, we can make a pivot from these things that we know are harmful to society, but also to individual patients, which we should talk about, for generations to come. But we can install new things that would put people to work building new energy generating things that are renewable and reusable and have no emissions. So there's this cartoon I have in one of my talks that's basically like, so what if it's all a hoax? And it's like, okay, well, we got clean water, clean air, free energy, no pollution, you know, cheaper this, cheaper that, more jobs. And like, so, I mean, like, I don't know, there's like many economic arguments for it outside of the health arguments and outside of the science arguments. But we should talk about individual populations. One of the things I haven't mentioned yet is that we also saw during the pandemic that different populations or groups or people were differentially impacted. And so, you know, climate change certainly affects vulnerable people more, particularly the very young and the very old, and also people of different socioeconomic classes. And there is a little bit of like sort of justice things where this, the US historically has emitted the most net amount of CO2, but countries like, you know, India, Pakistan, or sub-Saharan Africa are struggling more already with the impacts of climate change, despite having, you know, historically emitted far fewer tons of CO2. And so but even here in the US, there are kind of little pockets that are differentially impacted. So if you look at a city where there's a lot of tree cover, it gets less hot. But like the wealthy areas of the city have a lot of tree cover. And so the less wealthy areas of the city have fewer trees, are also closer to power plants. And so it turns out if you map a city based on like economics of different neighborhoods, it turns out that the poorer neighborhoods are closer to highways with more pollution or closer to power plants with more pollution, have fewer trees and less tree cover and get hotter. And it turns out that that's tends to be where different minority groups are clustered for sort of complicated historical reasons, including things like redlining. And so then you have, even within one city, the impacts of that we're seeing right now from climate change are very different. And there've been some very nice studies looking at atopic dermatitis admissions to the ED based on zip code, and that you can see, you know, living close to a highway or living close to a power plant in these groups, predominantly African-American patients, disproportionately impacted by the environmental impacts on the skin. And that really complicates both our care of those patients, but also our understanding of what exactly is, you know, the role of genetics versus the role of environment if there are historical practices that force clustering of different groups in different places in different cities. And so there's a lot to unpack there. Again, I've been monologuing. It's supposed to be a podcast and a dialogue, but
well, but this segues very nicely to an important group, and that's our patients. We need to educate. I mean, dermatologists need to be educated on this, physicians in general, but the whole community at large needs to. And we can actually take advantage of what we're learning, what I've just learned from you in the last 15 minutes. And so how do we reel our patients in? Do we even do that? Do we talk to our patients about climate change? I mean, is that how we spread the word? And do we add that into the conversation when we're sizing up a patient with atopic dermatitis who's from the inner city, who may be skin of color, who may be African-American, and maybe that's why you're having a flare right now because of climate change?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I feel like there's, you know, a lot of dermatologists have busy schedules and struggle with how much they should incorporate into their visits. And honestly, if I had any message for anyone, it would be just ask people if they're vaccinated, encourage them to get vaccinated, right? Like that's what we should probably be focusing on right at this very specific moment in history. It's so important, and we're so fortunate to have so many effective vaccines that for such a terrible disease that are so safe, so effective, and so well tolerated that it's literally a miracle, science miracle, but a miracle. But I think, you know, dermatologists are often like, for many patients, the only doctor that they might encounter, you know, for younger, healthy patients, teenagers, patients with acne, some older patients who come in very frequently for skin cancer, often have very close relationships with dermatologists. And fortunately right now, you know, physicians remain one of the few, you know, trusted voices as we're seeing with, you know, media polarization and distrust and social media and challenges of that. Still nurses and doctors are trusted voices. And so I think a lot of people hesitate to talk about this because they're worried it's politically charged. And I think there are vested interests that donate a lot to specific politicians about policymaking around these issues. But if you poll the population at large, many people are very aligned with this, where, you know, regardless of whether you identify as Republican or Democrat, still 70 to 80% of people either have witnessed or are worried about climate change impacts. And you can look at like the middle of this country, you know, Nebraska flooding and derechos and Texas hurricanes and Florida has been devastated. I mean,
incredible natural disasters. That was one that I was going to bring up too, is that we've seen all this, and that's not, there's no political sides for a natural disaster. Doesn't matter what side you're on at all.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, what people struggle with is, you know, okay, so there've always been hurricanes. So why are hurricanes so climate change? Well, again, we have science, right? So we know that hotter oceans will fuel more heat going up into the air and spin the clouds more and create more energy for more stronger storms, and that hotter humid air can hold more water. And it turns out that these hotter humid air storms actually move more slowly, so they dump more water, which is why like Harvey was so devastating to Houston. But I don't know that if a dermatologist, so after extreme flooding events, actually skin is the most commonly affected organ. And so more than respiratory illness, more than diarrheal illness, most people have skin issues, and this can be bacterial infections and fungal infections, mycobacterial infections, lacerations from trauma, animal bites, kind of contact derm, all sorts of things can happen. So I don't know if you're like a dermatologist seeing someone with like, you know, some issue after they've been displaced from a storm, you have to be like, okay, well, that's from climate change, and then get into a whole thing. But I do think we should start thinking about it and educating our patients where appropriate. But more than that, you know, again, there are experts in communication. And so there's actually an expert in climate science communication named Catherine Hayhoe. And she says one of the most important things is, interestingly, she's an evangelical Christian scientist who worked very hard on, you know, communication of some of these issues with people who tend to, without broad generalizing, cluster in one political party that may be somewhat insulated from some of the facts that she'd like to share. So she's worked very hard to say that one of the most important things you can do is just talk about it. So climate change is a major issue. People are scared to talk about it. Just talking about it alone helps kind of demystify it and de-taboo it. And I think just talking about it as professional societies is a good start. So having a podcast on it is great. Having, you know, coming to the AAD's lectures that cover climate change, or asking, you know, I mean, you, Brad, you're involved in like 400 things for the academy and the field. And so when you're hosting something or on a panel or on the board, you should bring this up and say, well, are we thinking about the climate impacts, or, you know, should we think about sustainability and healthcare?
Yeah, we talked a lot about DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusivity. And I think part of that inclusivity is including climate change really across the academy. I think they're really all important points. And obviously, it impacts our specialties you've alluded to in a number of different areas. How do we get this a little bit better? Obviously, we've got a lot to do in a reasonably short period of time. Can you discuss a few mitigation strategies and you know, how do we get towards carbon free? I mean, obviously, after reading some of this information myself, I want to get an electric car. I really do.
So it's great. And, you know, dermatologists probably can both afford electric cards. Electric cards are amazing and work phenomenally well. And now one of the things that they talk about is that it can power your home in the case of a blackout, that it's, you know, the batteries are so powerful for 3 days that that car can power your home. There are some tricks to that. So if you get your energy from a coal plant and you have an electric car and you charge the electric car from your energy, you know, spigot, and it's from a your personal energy is from like a coal burning power plant, it's unclear exactly that you're making like the most impact. But you can also look at your own personal energy purchase and say, well, you know, instead of getting my energy from this power plant, maybe I'd look at that power plant. Or for your practice, you could do that. Or if you work in a health system, you can say, So, again, this is where I will say some more personal things in a second, but you want to think about how you can magnify your impact, right? So if I walk to work, that's great. I save that much energy. If I could get like the whole city to walk to work, that would save even more energy, right? And so if I say, well, I should make a choice on my own that will get me carbon neutral, that's great. But one of the things we know is that like 70 to 80% of pollution comes from like 50 companies. And there's an argument, again, that personal choice alone is not going to get us out of this. It's going to take kind of industry decision and government response. But, you know, again, not to point fingers at you and make the job yours, but like imagine the academy meeting. You can say to every pharma sponsor, well, you know, do you really need to give out X, Y, and Z plastic bags or put A, B, and C things on people's doors at the academy? Or maybe you want to help purchase carbon offsets, or, you know, plant trees, or, you know, the day of service that the academy does could be like climate focused, you know, or, you know, even more than that, one of the things that we know that is our biggest source of carbon emissions is air travel. When I say ours, I mean the people who probably are listening to this podcast. So that's about 3% of people in the world fly. It's like a very small number. It is a huge source of carbon emissions. So if you could eliminate one flight, that probably makes almost as much of a difference as everything else that you would do. And so one thing that we see with the pandemic is we can have virtual meetings fairly successfully. And so I'm not saying that we shouldn't have an in-person academy meeting. That's important. I think once a year for the field to get together is really important. But if you think about kind of all sorts of little state and local meetings often have, you know, an invited speaker or two, do you really lose a lot by having that person give a virtual talk versus the carbon footprint of that? Or does that meeting even need to be in person? Or could that meeting, you know, be substituted with a virtual meeting?
Well, I'll share with the audience that you gave a great talk virtually at a meeting that I was at in Orlando, which is actually one of the first live meetings that has been in the entire country, which was just this past couple of weeks. And, you know, it was great. It looked like you were right there. You know, the only thing is that maybe the question to answer part is a little bit more tricky when you're not right there, but it still works. I think you're absolutely right. And there's a lot of opportunity for us to really minimize the travel, just like you said. One thing before we move on. What was it that I was reading? Tire burning is one of the worst source of these emissions that you're talking about too. Now we should be able to do something about that.
Yeah. Okay. So we as society should be able to do something about that. We as Brad and Misha, this is where I struggle with like, so actually there are so many areas that you could point to where we could have an impact, and like residency selection, you know, you think about, you know, people flying cross country for 20 interviews, you know, maybe that should be all virtual. There's like a long list of things you can point to. I do want to say actually I said I'd talk a little bit more about individual choice. So one thing I want to say is the AAD actually has a member benefit with a group called My Green Doctor that was started by Todd Sack, who's a Florida-based physician. And it has a ton of fantastic resources for like greening the office, you know, sort of renewing, reusing and recycling things, kind of finding. And it's all focused on cost neutral or cost saving measures. So this is not something where you have to invest like $100,000 to green your office. And some of it's like, you know, power saving bulbs and low energy this and LEDs. But you know, you think about like how cold you keep your rooms, does it really need to be 66 degrees or could it be 70 degrees? And do you lose a lot? And you know, what are your cost savings and things like that? But so, you know, so the AAD had this member benefit for about 2 years. I think at last count, like 10 dermatologists signed up to use it. And so there are some low-hanging fruit things that can be tapped into. And I would just say, if anyone cares about this, there are experts who can help hold their hand and guide them through this. There's something called Medical Society Consortium for Climate and Health that has fantastic resources. New England Journal and Lancet have dedicated either sections or parts of their journal to climate change. It's not hard to find you know, scientific articles for how this pertains to medicine, certainly, but to dermatology in particular. It's also not hard to find resources that can at least make a little bit of an impact. But, you know, part of this is what level of impact should we be pushing for? So, you know, for the academy, should the academy make some larger scale changes specifically focused on climate and carbon and sustainability and healthcare? And no one's going to do anything unless people ask for people to do stuff. But it, well, you know, the science tells us we should do stuff.
One of the ways things happen too is by getting groups of people together and growing those groups who have interest that can spread the word and educate. Tell us a little bit about, as we close here, the ERG. What is it? Who founded it? Who's in it? And what it can do to really benefit expanding the education in climate change.
Thanks. Actually, that's a great question. So an ERG is an expert resource group. The Academy started developing expert resource groups. I'm not an expert on Academy history or whatever, but let's go with about 10 or 15 years ago. And I was actually a member of one expert resource group called the Society for Derm Hospitalists, which focuses on inpatient derm, which is like my day job. And so there was a number of dermatologists who cared about this issue who sort of coalesced. And I should give full credit, Mary Williams at UCSF, she's a dermatologist, pediatric dermatologist, focused on atopic dermatitis. She gave a fantastic talk on heat-related illness and the skin as a sweat organ and thermoregulatory organ, and really just real expert in this issue. Mary Williams, I think, was like sort of the nidus for this. And then David Fivenson, who's affiliated with University of Michigan, but in private practice in Michigan. That was kind of the core group. And then immediately sort of a number of other people, and I don't want to start naming names because I'm going to forget people, but important people supported this, you know, past president of the Academy, Suzanne Albrecht, who was president at the time that started, Henry Lim, Bill James, you know, people who have some clout, Mary Maloney, and then a number of like young, motivated dermatologists, Caroline Nelson, Jonathan Barbieri, Eva Parker. I'm definitely going to forget like one person.
I feel like I'm at the Academy Awards. You're right. Accepting an award.
So I will say, so now there's about 150 people who are on our like listserv. Oh, Marcus Booz is the one I was going to forget. And Sarah Coates, but who run our listserv. But, so we have about 150 dermatologists on listserv, you know, there's a ton of alignment with, you know, Young Physicians Group and Skin of Color Society from some of the issues that we've talked about, Medical Dermatology Society and some managing these things, Society of Pediatric Dermatology. And so we try to interface with other parts, but really to the credit of the Academy and the board, the board has reached out to us as it's not really just the climate change expert resource group, it's called the Climate Change Environmental Affairs Expert Resource Group. And so the Academy has reached out for things like, hey, can you help us with our messaging around, you know, sunscreen and coral bleaching and things like that. Oh, and I should, as a disclaimer, say that I'm obviously involved in this expert resource group and I'm one of the co-chairs, but everything I say is on my behalf and not on behalf of the American Academy of Dermatology. I'm speaking for Misha, not for the Academy of Dermatology. But so if dermatologists hear this and are interested in getting involved, they can certainly email me. They can reach out to our ERG. They can reach out to the Academy. You can plug them in with the ERG. Basically email anyone you know and they can plug you in with us. You know, we have a number of projects and initiatives and things that we would love to get more folks involved in, which range from everything like putting on educational activity, where we've had some webinars and we have a session at the Academy, to writing articles, again, you know, this themed issue, but also beyond that, to kind of specific tasks like, you know, can we help the Academy offer carbon offsets for coming to the meeting? Or can we show the Academy, you know, potential benefits of a hybrid meeting versus a solely in-person versus a solely virtual meeting and things like that. And there's a lot of work to do, but a lot of people who are super motivated about what really is a critical issue facing certainly the field to some degree, medicine certainly, but our society really, which is I think, you know, the big part that we all belong to.
Well, clearly impacts our specialty and it's impacting our world. I know that I appreciate the opportunity to have had an opportunity to discuss this with you. And I know that our listeners will. And I really think that we need a part two. So I'm going to ask you to come back at some point and we can maybe dig into some more specifics. But I think if nothing else, just enlightening our academy, our group of dermatologists out there who will be listening to this podcast as the minimum that I would hope out of this and start to get people involved, educate our patients. And so, Misha, I want to say thank you so much. And I look forward to us doing this again in the future.
Oh, thanks so much, Brad. I appreciate it. And thank you again for all that you do for our specialty and all of us. So thanks, and thanks for highlighting this issue.
To keep up with all the latest news in dermatology, check out hcplive.com. and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Make sure to subscribe to this podcast on all your favorite platforms. Stay tuned for the next Durham Discussions with Dr. Brad Glick. Thank you for listening.